November 14th is the birthday of Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy, born in Grand Chute in 1908. More than anyone else, McCarthy is associated with the communist witch hunts that took place in the U.S. in the early 1950s during the depths of the Cold War.
For today's Wisconsin Legends segment, we'll get some insights into the rise and fall of Joe McCarthy. Gerald Poder is with us. He's professor of history and American studies at Lawrence University. Gerald, welcome to the Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be talking with you from Joe McCarthy's hometown.
Right. Well, Joe McCarthy, as we said, he's associated with this intense phase of anti-communism. As he grew up in and around Grand Chute, Wisconsin, how did that shape his politics?
Well, you know, the Grand Chute area, the Appleton area generally, is a culturally conservative area. And that's the environment that Joe grew up in. He is a Catholic, as I said, culturally conservative, a devout Catholic his whole life. And that really shapes, I think, his outlook to the world. He's also a poor boy, and that shapes his populist outlook to the world. Or towards the world. So when you combine this cultural conservatism, Joe is a go-getter, is a pull himself up by the bootstraps kind of man. When you combine all of that, you have a brew that is conducive to anti-communism once the time comes.
Now, he was only 38 years old. He defeated one of the La Follettes for a seat in the U.S. Senate. Can you tell us something about how he went on to victory in that case?
Well, that's a very interesting campaign. He actually capitalized on Robert La Follette Jr.'s, you know, sometimes we talk about Potomac fever, senators getting Potomac fever, and they start forgetting about where they came from. I think by 1946, that would describe Robert La Follette Jr. He wasn't really in contact all that much with his home state. He was known as a national and even internationally oriented senator. So McCarthy was able to take advantage of that. McCarthy traveled the length of the state, 16, 18-hour days, retail campaigning, made his customary exaggerated charges against La Follette that he was a draft dodger, that he was a millionaire, and was just able to squeak through by about 5,000 votes of out of about 400,000. La Follette also didn't help himself by leaving the Progressive Party, which he had founded in the 1930s with his brother Philip, for the Republican Party, coming back to the Republican Party in 1946. It was a much more conservative organization than the one he had left, and he was almost like a fish out of water. So actually, it's surprising that McCarthy didn't win by more than 5,000 votes under the circumstances.
So he wins this narrow election at a young age, but he quickly emerges as one of the nation's best-known anti-communists. How did that happen?
Well, you know, McCarthy's first couple of years in the Senate were very undistinguished, and in one poll of a national magazine, he was described as the least popular senator in the Senate. In February 1950, however, he capitalized on the emerging anti-communist hysteria in the United States by making a celebrated speech, not in Wisconsin, he made it in Wheeling, West Virginia, where he waved a piece of paper and said, "I hold in my hand the names of 205 state department employees who are known security risks and who are still, even though they are known security risks, working in the State Department." And this was really the signal to begin a rather partisan campaign, not just on the part of McCarthy, but other congressional Republicans, on the Truman administration as being soft on communism.
So about that piece of paper he was waving with all the names on it, I mean, was there anything to that? Where did he get those names?
And as usual with McCarthy, it's murky. When he actually had to introduce a number into the congressional record on the floor of Congress, he chose the number 57. And it's difficult to ascertain where he came up with either 205 or 57. Some people think that he came up with 205 because he had access to a security report from the Secretary of State, Truman's Secretary of State, who had said that, I think he said that we have a report where there are 284 security risks, but 79 of them have been removed. So if you subtract 79 from 284, you have 205. And I think that's where he might have come up with that, except that report was 4 years old by the time he got around to citing it. It was a 1946 report, so it probably wasn't very accurate. Joe McCarthy was a glib, a shrewd man, but facts were flexible, were malleable, shall we say.
This was not a one-man crusade in Congress, in the Senate, and the House. Who were some of his key allies?
Well, it's interesting. The Republicans by 1950, the National Republicans, are a party desperate for victory in the presidential race. They have lost five consecutive presidential elections, and most recently in 1948 when they felt they should have won. So they rally around McCarthy, and one of his biggest supporters is a Senate Majority Leader Robert Taft, the dean of Senate Republicans, Mr. Republican, and his support mostly in Congress or in the Senate comes from Midwestern conservative Republicans. William Jenner of Indiana is another name. Carl Mundt of South Dakota is another name. So he's powerful and popular among Senate Republicans because they see McCarthy and McCarthyism as a way to take back the White House.
Now, you said that for Senator McCarthy, facts were flexible. I mean, he had his allies, but he was also politically shrewd. How much did he believe what he was saying? Was it political opportunism or was it more Machiavellian?
Well, my feeling is that his sentiments evolved. In February 1950, when he made that Wheeling speech with the 205 names, I think he was much more of a political opportunist. As time went on, I think he became more and more convinced that there was a grave communist threat in the United States, that there was a espionage problem in the United States, and became much more sincere and convinced that this cause was the correct cause. Now, in some individuals, that might mean that he evolves as a moral human being, as you become more sincere. But for McCarthy, his evolving true anti-communism allowed him basically to suspend the rules of decency, to suspend the rules of morality. That's what a true believer does. When you become a true believer in any cause, rules, laws, morality, that's for other people. You view the nation as in a crisis. And in a crisis, all the rules go out the window. That's where McCarthy was by 1954 when the famous Army-McCarthy hearings began.
Let's talk about that hearing and its role in the fall of McCarthy as a prominent national anti-communist figure.
Well, in April 1954, the Senate Committee on Governmental Operations, of which McCarthy was a member, began an investigation of McCarthy's charges that the Army was filled with communists and the Army's charges that McCarthy was harassing them. During these hearings, which lasted until June 1954, there was a bit of comic opera, a bit of drama. But finally, in the end, since these hearings were televised, McCarthy's bullying tactics, cutting witnesses off, making sarcastic remarks, showing a disdain for civil liberties, and finally a disdain for human decency, brought him down. Because in the climactic moment of the hearings, the counsel for the Army, the lawyer for the Army, Joseph Welch, made a famous remark. And, of course, in an era of sound bites, this is what you remember. He says to McCarthy, "Have you no decency, sir? At long last, have you no decency?" And that's the remark that we remember the most from those hearings. McCarthy was unable to answer that. It was actually brought about by McCarthy's attempt to smear a lawyer in Welch's law firm as a communist, which Welch thought was a low blow. He protests when McCarthy tries to talk over him. That's when Welch says, "Have you no decency, sir?" And the hearing room erupts in applause. And you can almost see the air or feel the air going out of McCarthy's balloon right there and then. Immediately after the hearings concluded, a motion was made in the Senate to censure him. And in December of 1954, he was one of the very few senators formally condemned, formally censured by the U.S. Senate.
Now, that's one strand of his downfall. What about his appearance with Edward R. Murrow? Did Murrow play a part in breaking him on national TV?
Well, I think he did, because Murrow's two See It Now episodes went on the air right around the time that the Army-McCarthy hearings were about to start. And right before the hearing started in April 1954, McCarthy had a very, very high approval rating in the United States. It was up around 60%. So Murrow taking him on at that time was actually an act of bravery. Murrow, of course, is a very well-respected figure, and I think those shows actually did play a role in starting, at least beginning, McCarthy's downfall. The Army-McCarthy hearings did the rest. McCarthy appeared on an episode of See It Now with Murrow and did not distinguish himself. That also was the case as well.
Gerald, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to Gerald Podair about Senator Joe McCarthy, who was born this day, November 14th in 1908, in Grand Chute, Wisconsin.